Slowly, slowly, people to arrive. Look at what consists of when we call it a precious human rebirth, not just a human rebirth. So we talked about the eight freedoms. You can see that if you're not free from these things, then it makes it very difficult to practice, yeah? To do spiritual practices. Can you see the point of discussing this? This is the thing. Like, what one tries to do instead of thinking, oh, I don't have this and I don't have this and I don't have that, that we start to appreciate what we have. In order to bring the mind up, because a very unhappy mind, for a very unhappy mind, it's very difficult to practice, really, you know, to sit down and watch the mind and meditate and all this. If you have a lot of unhappiness in your life, then maybe better at the beginning go out and have fun with your friends until the mind is back up. So this meditation is for that, is to bring up the mind so that it appreciates the present situation. And then we have the endowments or the richnesses. The first one is being human. Yeah, so that's a good thing to be human because we have this human intellect who can figure things out. Yeah, and who can bear hardships for the long-term benefit. Yeah, if you go to the dentist, nobody has to tie you down. Aup. Or what? Yeah? Whereas if you go with your dog and the dentist wants to do the same thing as with you, you have to tie the dog down or you have to put the dog asleep. You have to, you know, because that's what animals cannot. Animals cannot bear pain for the long-term benefit. I know there's always examples that you see on YouTube and all this. I'm talking in general, okay? In general. Being born in a central land with at least four fully ordained monks, because it's four fully ordained monks who keep the vows, so it should actually say pure monks, who then become the Sangha jewel as a refuge. And in general, I don't know if I would still be practicing so earnestly and on the path if I would not be a nun, to be honest. Because you become a nun, you really let everything else go, like relationships, children, your own house, your own car, and all this is like, you don't need to think about this anymore. It's just no, you know. So, because so many things, you know, you can be so inspired on this path. And so many things can come that can totally, you know, put you somewhere else. So, a career, children, a partner, a house, you know, all these kind of things. So this is why it's really the Sangha, the ordained Sangha, that is holding up the teachings also, it is said. When there's the Buddha said, I think it's the Buddha who stated it, when there's no more ordained Sangha, also Buddhism will vanish, will disappear. I would give this the shadow of a doubt, because now we have very serious lay Dharma teachers. So I don't know, but from the time of the Buddha, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, just be happy that there's still some of those around. Well, it's the Buddha who said it's the ordained Sangha who is keeping the teachings more serious, you know, because they have less distraction. I'm not saying that they don't deviate from the path. Also ordained people, they also disrobe. But in general, you know, I mean, it's lay people who tell me this. They say sometimes, look, we started practicing together, but because I went this way and, you know, lay teachers also, they usually have family. So, you know, I don't have family. I can give all my time to this. If you have children, they're not necessarily happy that you're a Dharma teacher. So you have to go and spend time with them, for example. So you could say at least for them, the emphasis is on the morality. Yeah. Having all the sense organs intact, something that you need, which is very handy to practice and to study. At one point, we had a blind man in Dharamsala, Situ. I don't know if any of you remembers him. He was an Indian. It was very difficult for him. He wanted to come down to the library. He had to wait until somebody would take him by his hand. Usually it was me. It was difficult, you know, because then I was late every time also because he could only walk slow. And so people would see us sometimes in the street walking hand in hand. And, you know, he didn't have a white stick where you could see that he's blind. So they were kind of, sometimes I got really dirty looks from the Tibetan. What is this nun doing with this hand, with this lay person hand in hand and like this? But it's very difficult for him. For me, it wasn't difficult. And I could also see, you know, sometimes when I didn't feel like it, I had the thought, oh, you know, I just walked by. He can't see me. This is how we are. This is how I am, you know. So then whenever I saw that I had this thought, I would especially take him. But the temptation to, he can't see me. Well, let somebody else take him, you know. Then I remember, you know, I said, I by myself alone will lead all sentient beings to full awakening. And I don't even take him down to the library. One. So where is my bodhisattva commitment here? Where is it? Right. Then not having committed the five heinous crimes. Five heinous crimes are these five actions that are considered the gravest or the biggest. It's like having killed your father or your mother. So that's two. And not regretting it. This is what comes to thinking that's a very good thing that I did that. Because it happens. It happens that children kill their parents voluntarily, thinking that this is a good thing because they're so confused. Yeah. One is like killing somebody who's very realized, killing an arhat, you know, somebody who has high spiritual realizations, killing the Dalai Lama, for example, or other spiritual teachers that are very influential, that make a big difference in the world, who can influence people by just being present. If you kill somebody like this, injuring a Buddha, but anyway, we don't know who a Buddha is, so like that. And what is also quite heavy karma is splitting the Sangha, splitting a spiritual group, and then they stop practicing. You know, you have meditation groups like the one in Enapsaw that is really already quite well established and is practicing well. Somebody comes and says, oh, you know, I don't like this person, therefore, you know, creating a lot of disharmony in the group. Maybe the person wants to put up his or her own group and starts to create disharmony, and then the group breaks apart because of disharmony and nobody wants to step down, whatever, and then they all stop practicing. That would be one of the heinous crimes. So it's not just splitting up the group, it's causing them to stop practicing. Okay? So I don't think we're in the danger of doing that anyway, so you don't have to worry about that one. But if you have committed any of these things, then it's very difficult for the mind to make progress on the path. This one? The Dharma friends, yeah, the Dharma friends as a whole, I would say. This group here, no, because we don't, I don't know, many of them, you don't know. No, it was just an example. I don't think you have to worry about this. Yeah, no. Also, this some texts say it's only when the Buddha is present. You want to go against the Buddha, you split the Sangha. So like this. Huh? Not in that sense, no. But it's still not positive karma if you do it. Okay, this is what I mean, you know. It's not one of the five heinous crimes because the conditions are missing, but it's still not a good thing to do, to create disharmony and then the group splits and then it breaks apart and that's it, you know. So, you know, when it's said that, no, this is not a, it's not a full negative actions or whatever, but it's still negative. We'll talk about this afternoon. It's like, yeah, don't do it. The the Chinese army soldiers, not the Chinese, the Chinese army. Yeah, and tortured them. Yeah. Yeah, and? Of course, whomever you torture and you kill is negative karma. It's one of the negative actions is to kill. It doesn't matter who it is. No. No. Also, why are you worrying about the Chinese soldiers? You know, we don't have that much time. They might be there already dead. So why are we worrying about those? Yeah, it's like we should not kill. Doesn't matter who, you know. This is a good way of thinking. Should not kill. Not think, oh, this one, yeah, maybe I can kill this one. Maybe, you know, because we don't know. So then what is really needed on this path? This is the next one. Having faith in the teachings and in your own abilities to attain that goal. And having faith only comes through studying and to practicing. It's not blind faith. Okay? It would be very strange if in your first course of hearing about Buddhism, you go out of here and say, yes, I want to attain enlightenment. I'm going to practice this path. That I wouldn't trust that. You know, if some people after 10 days even then come and say, I want to take refuge, me personally, I usually say, no, it's far too early. Wait, 2 years, 3 years, go to groups, go to retreats, practice this. And then if you still say, yes, I want to practice this, when you know what it's all about, then okay, take refuge, you know. But if you already now have some faith that this could work and some faith in your own ability, that's good. It's a starting point, you know. But it needs both. When you go to chemotherapy, for the chemotherapy to work really well, it needs both. It needs the faith in the medicine, but it also needs the faith in you that you have the ability to heal. We all know about placebo effect. Okay? So it's very important that we have this faith. So then, you know, how can you develop it? By thinking, what can I lose if I have it? What can you lose? What's the benefit of starting to believe that you're a good person? What's the disadvantage of keeping thinking that you're a bad person? You don't have this ability to grow until all the negative emotions are eliminated. You find out, you know. We're so weak. We have so little self-confidence. It's amazing, you know. On the other hand, we're so arrogant. It goes together, by the way. Low self-confidence and arrogance is dual package. Yeah. So you learn to be humble and ordinary, your low self-esteem goes. This is the funny thing. You become normal. You're not the center of the universe. You just think you are. And everybody thinks like this. That's the problem. Everybody thinks I'm special. It's due to me. I need this. Why? Okay? If we start to really believe, I can do this. I can be the person I want to be. Not harming others, and instead of not just not harming others, on top of it, helping them. I can let go of my self-cherishing and selfish thinking and all this. And then you do these, you adapt these ways of thinking. Maybe you notice by now, when I talk about methods and practices, it is ways of thinking to change your habits. That's all. Nothing else, nothing less. Then we need to be be reborn in a time where there was an enlightened being, like a historical Buddha, like Shakyamuni Buddha. He's a historical Buddha, yeah. Like maybe all these Tibetans that were maybe also enlightened beings, they're not historical Buddhas because they don't say that they are enlightened. In one era, there's only one who clearly states, "I have overcome the causes of suffering. I have attained full liberation." There's only one. Okay, that's a historical Buddha. So we need to have been born in that, or it's good to have to be born in that time, because then the teachings are still practiced. But you know, and then the next one is teachings remain in an undegenerated state. They do not remain, they're not in an undegenerated state. If you would get teachings from a Tibetan Lama who teaches only Tibetan monks, after half an hour you would leave. Unless you really know the teachings already and you really want to study, because they're boring. They give you the information. They're not trying to make it comfortable for you to swallow it. And this is why the teachings degenerate, because we're too weak to take the essence of it. It needs to sound nice and appealing, and, you know, like the mother who is tricking you into eating spinach. So, you know, and there are fake teachers around also, because people are so desperate for being acknowledged and heard and seen and loved and all this, you know, then they take advantage of that. Maybe not even consciously. But people proclaim their own teachings somehow, you know. Distorted, because it's, yeah, I mean, if I could leave out a lot of things, you know, because I know what people don't like to hear. We could only talk about compassion. People like to hear that. We could do nice meditations where you open your heart and you send out light and all this. But if you don't do the first steps, that compassion will not hold. It will not work. It will be very nice here with a very open heart and you feel very good. The moment you go out and somebody honks next to you, boom, the heart is closed again. Okay? So I do leave certain things out. Like, for example, the teachings on the descriptions of the lower states. Because I asked the Lama, I said, what shall I leave out? Because I can't do everything in this. Also, it's a very short time, you know. What we're studying here, you study this in a real study program for 2 years. Just that, what we're doing in 2.5 days. So I asked him what to leave out. He said, well, you know, stop talking about the lower states because they don't believe it anyway, he said. And if you insist, they will start throwing stones at you. So that's what he said. And then he said, but make sure they understand dukkha, their own suffering. Yeah, so. And it is a little, it is also packed in all of it is cultural. But if we make the decision, oh, this I don't like, I throw out, I wonder how beneficial it will be. It's like saying, oh, you know, if you have different kinds of medicines that the doctor put together for you, and then you say, oh, this one I don't like because it's pink, and I really don't like pink, I throw it out. I wonder if the other medicines work just as well if that pink one is missing. I'm not sure. Yeah, this is why we have to structure here. And I know some of you look really bored. I'm really sorry, you know. Try to sit up a little bit, because otherwise I also feel like maybe we should stop, you know. Yeah. Okay, so this historical Buddha also needs to have taught the path to enlightenment, because otherwise, you know, there's probably many Buddhas around, because the Buddhas keep coming back again and again and again to be of benefit to us in all kinds of forms, we don't know, where it can help us, because they make these aspirations. As you know, as it says in Shantideva's second or third chapter, may I be a bridge, may I be medicine, may I be food for the beings who need it, may I be a boat, may I be a ship, blah, blah. They make all these aspirations to be everything that people need to be happy. Okay? So, but if they don't teach, if they don't say, I'm a Buddha, then the Buddhism doesn't get established. Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth in this time area that we have here now. Okay. Then also what we need is that the teachings are still being practiced. Because if nobody practices them and you just read a book, I don't think you would be inspired to start practicing. Yeah, we need people around us, the Sangha, people who, you know, when after 2 years it gets really boring and you feel tired, and then go and talk to them. What somebody said also is like what, because some Sanghas are really good at this. They discuss personal things with each other. Other people get upset and say, oh, this is not a self-help group. Sangha is a self-help group. But what you learn to self-help yourself is the methods of the Dharma and not so much just the method of psychology, you see. And when that is missing, then the warmth is missing in the Sangha. And this is the glue for the Sangha, this exchange, exchanging joys and pains in your practice with them. And very often we think people are not interested or they have enough to do or whatever. Studying together is great. But then how you put it into your daily life, discussing that is also part of Sangha. And then you need trust to open up that they will keep it to themselves and not use it against you. And sometimes, you know, they will use it against you, but then what? Are we going like somebody who says, oh, I'd rather not open up, and then missing all the joys of opening up because of being afraid of being hurt and disappointed at one point, okay? Do you see what I mean, you know? We miss so many joys because we're so afraid of disappointment. Why? Disappointment is part of life. What? Because we are living in illusions. So you can grow with your disappointments. You can say, yes, the Buddha is right. This is not the cause for happiness, by being disappointed. And then people in general need to be kind-hearted, because otherwise also we don't continue with the practice, okay? Because if everybody around says, well, how stupid you are to generate a good heart, don't know how long you would practice, you know? So at the moment, I think it's still, being good-hearted is still a good thing. I know that many people, sometimes say, well, you know, people take advantage of you, you are naive when you're good-hearted. So then to prove that person wrong, you can start to be really nasty to that person who says things like, hey, you're so naive, you're so good-hearted, you're so kind. Then stop being kind to that person. And then when he or she says something, you can say, oh, you know, I just didn't want to be naive anymore. You see, everybody appreciates when we are kind to them. But when we're kind to others, they say it's naive. And sometimes also these people take advantage of us. But you see, if you really want to give, you will never feel exploited. If you buy a present for somebody, the person takes the present, says thank you, do you feel exploited because they took away that thing from you? Huh? No. It's only when you don't really want to give and people force it out of you, then you feel exploited. But even a Buddhist can say no when they feel it's not good for the other person that you just give. But for the other person's sake and not for your sake. And unfortunately, we stop always too quickly with these needy people saying, oh, it doesn't help them, it doesn't make them content. Who knows? You know, we're so afraid. What are you afraid of? You know, when we look how we choose to whom we give, business, you know. This is from Jesus, okay? Jesus said, and I think it's really great, you should give your love to those who deserve it the least because they need it the most. Yeah. Buddhism goes in that direction. It doesn't say it so explicitly in one sentence, but the whole teaching is about that. It's too easy just to love the ones that are easy to love if you want to grow. Of course, if you don't want to grow, then again, no need to learn to love the ones who really need it. No need. But if you want to grow, if you want to open your heart to all beings, then that's what you have to do. Yeah. It's possible, but you still love all the others in the same way also, you know, this is the thing. But conventionally, you know that this one maybe needs more attention, you give it. And that for the other kids is very difficult. And your guru, by the way, is the same. He gives a lot of attention to those who need it. So if your guru doesn't pay any attention to you, it's a good sign. And then don't get jealous. Yeah. It's like, a guru is like a doctor. You know, what kind of doctor would you be if you spend a lot of time with the patients who are already healthy? Yeah. And then you are healthy and the doctor doesn't look at you anymore, doesn't even ask you anymore, how are you, but is looking at her who is still sick. What, are you going to be jealous? I didn't mean you're sick yet. Okay, we're all sick. We're all in the same boat. You see, this is what Leora says. When we see that sometimes we can do this, no problem. But other times when we feel negative emotions coming up, then we have to question that. Why do I feel jealous here? You know? Would I feel jealous of a doctor who spends time with his patient when I don't need him anymore? You don't continue to go to the doctor when you're healthy. Can you imagine? They already have much too much work. And we should help others the same way as a doctor or a psychologist or psychiatrist helps the patient. You want this patient to grow up. You want this patient to go and live on their own. You don't want this patient to kind of keep in your skirts, kind of, you know. You really want to help him in such a way that they can say, thank you very much, I don't need you anymore. As a therapist, well, you would be very happy. If your friends say that, thank you very much, I'm going, I don't need you anymore, would you be just as happy? We would be angry at them, feel exploited. Do you feel exploited when they say, bye, I don't need you anymore, I'm not going to pay you any more bills because I don't need you anymore? You feel happy. We can do this if we understand why we are helping. Do we help them to be so that they become dependent on us? Or do we help them because we really want them to make the step so that they can stay on their own feet? I don't know how it is as a psychologist. You help somebody really, really well, and then you meet them and they don't recognize you. How does that feel? Huh?
I don't know.
Oh. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, so a precious human rebirth comes about. So when these factors are present and you use it to make steps on the path of awakening, then we call it a precious human rebirth. And a precious human rebirth has causes that you practiced in a previous life, not in this life. And the causes are when you keep pure morality, meaning you're not harming anybody, and harming anybody in a way, harming them and thinking it's a good thing to do. We come to karma this afternoon, okay? You keep pure morality and you practice generosity and patience and you make specific aspirations. You know, in this little text that we're reading here, the last two verses are, or even just the last verse is, in all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Ajadhara. This is making the right aspirations. You put information on your mind stream that when you meet the Dharma again, you are happy. Because that's what you're looking for, even if not consciously. Yeah, and I can see this in courses at Tushita, for example. Yeah, at Tushita, you have 60, 70, 80 people. You give them a 10-day instruction course. For some few people, maybe two out of these 80 people, sometimes nobody. It really clicks. They drop all their travel arrangements. They even throw away their ticket back home, and as long as the money lasts, they stay in Dharamsala, go to the library, study every day, come to the groups, continue to practice as long as they have the money to do this. Not in every course. It's quite rare. Maybe in 1 year, I would say 4 out of 12 times 80 is how much? Huh? Yeah. Out of these thousands, maybe even 4 is quite high. Yeah. Then some people say, yeah, it's very nice, you know, maybe if I go back home, I have a look and I practice, and well, they continue with their job. Some people leave before it's finished out of anger. The bullshit, what are you saying, blah, 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 you know. At one point it was what we're going to talk about now, about impermanence and death, how death can come any moment and all this. And one person got so angry that he packed his bag and he left. I was in Bogaya. And then he got attacked by dacoits, which are bandits. He didn't get killed because he was an Israeli and he was a soldier. So he said, I survived 2 wars. What are you telling me? Death can come any moment. He was so angry. He drove out with the rickshaw. The dacoits come and they have these shotguns that are self-made. With one shot, you have 40 little pellets in your body. So then he had this in his body, and we had to take him to the doctor and then to Delhi and then back home and whatever, you know. He wasn't dead, that's true, but if they would have aimed a little bit higher, that would have been it, you know. So that's the next topic. What we have to look at, and in the verse before still, it's like understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once. We looked at what is a precious human rebirth, okay? That's what we did until now. What do we do with this situation now? We have to understand it is precious. And here it said, found only once. We should treat it as if it is found only once. This is not true. It's not found only once, because you need a situation like we are in now to create the causes for the next precious human rebirth. If you are, you know, living under terrible conditions, you cannot be ethical and survive. It's impossible. You have to fight. You have to steal. You have to lie. Yeah? We have the luxury, the privilege, to be able to choose if we want to be ethical or not. Many beings don't. And many beings don't have time to do these practices. They're busy with surviving, you know. So this is why we should treat it found only once, because we don't know what is going to happen to us in our next rebirth. No idea where we will go if we have the opportunity to practice again. So it is precious, it's greatly meaningful. Why? Because it's only with a situation like this you can attain enlightenment, or you can make progress on the path to full awakening. Okay? That's why it's meaningful. It's difficult to find again, you know. Being really ethical is very difficult, even for us whom we have the privilege. Being patient is really difficult. Patient. Being generous is really difficult. I mean, generosity is a mind that gives as much as it can give. A mind that is happy giving. Do we have this mind? If we would have this mind, we wouldn't have any poor people, nowhere, because we would share freely and not hoarding. Generosity is a mind that feels rich. I can give something. So if you train the mind to give as much as you can, this moment you feel rich and happy. A mind who is looking, what can I get? Even if your bank account has 10 millions, is a mind of poverty. So you can choose. These are the things we can start choosing, you know. Am I really generous? Do I give as much as I can? And it's not just a dana here, it's in your daily life. Do I give as much as I can? Do I give with kindness, with consideration for the other? You know, you have, let's say, You have two books. They're the same books. Somebody gave you a new book, but you already have the book. And you decide to give one away. Which one do you give away? The old one or the new one? Yeah. The old one. It's like, of course, the old one. Why? The old one is yours. This is not used yet. You know, if it's a Dharma book, you can give it to the shop here and they can sell it so that they can invite more teachers and keep these things going, for example. But it's so natural. We give away the old stuff. And then we expect the people to say thank you. Well, for you, it's like different. What? It would be difficult to give the new one. Yeah. But at least when you give away your old clothes, do not expect people to say thank you. You are the one who should say thank you, because that prevents you from having to throw it away, because you're too stingy to throw it away. Right? So you want other people to say, oh, thank you very much. You are the one who needs to say thank you. Because on top of it, they allow you to practice generosity with your old schmottes there. And you feel so generous and so noble, you know? Come on. Anyway, it's very precious, the precious human rebirth. Difficult to find again. So then, you know, in this text here, we ask for inspiration. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly takes its essence day and night. It doesn't mean you can't sleep anymore. You can still sleep, okay? But it means that when you go to sleep with a good intention, with a happy mind. Wow, you know, I spent the day not harming anybody. I did what I was asked to do. Like if you're asked to keep discipline here and you keep silence, unless I or Gidi or Liora is asking you something, then that's not breaking the silence, because sometimes we need to ask something. I'm not coming to you for a chat. If I do address you, I address you, there's a reason, because maybe I want to know how you are, or whether the point was understood, something like that. So you don't need to feel bad about this when you answer me, okay, or you answer Gidi or answer Liora. But when you really can say in the evening, wow, I was able to keep the discipline. Look at your mind. Is it a happy mind or is it a sad mind? When you go, also very honest, I didn't keep the discipline. Is it a happy mind or is it a sad mind? You see, they say the cause for happiness is keeping discipline. And it's true. So you might have encountered hardships during the day to keep silence. But if you do it, there's the satisfaction in the evening that you kept the discipline. If you never keep the discipline, if you never keep agreements, how can there be satisfaction if you constantly break rules? There is also satisfaction breaking rules, but that satisfaction is very short-lived until somebody finds out, and then you feel embarrassed. Yeah? I was a great breaker of rules. It was, you know, it was like this was the game that we were playing when we were young. But the satisfaction that comes from keeping discipline, that you have decided you want to keep it, you decided to come on this course. Nobody forced you. But there is rules. The same way you want to join a club, you have to abide by the rules, otherwise you get thrown out. So whenever you feel that this is too much or whatever, remember, you decided to come here. Yeah? And keeping discipline is a mind that is free. A mind that can keep discipline is a free mind. Gives you so much freedom. No choice. Should I not talk? Should I not? It's like, no. Free. Unfortunately, we don't see the benefit of discipline because we don't really practice it. And we think we do it for the sake of somebody else. But you do it for your own sake. Yeah. To be able to tell the mind, stop wanting that. And it stops. That's freedom. Not to take everything that the mind wants and then you get it and you want something else and something else and something else. That is called being a slave of your wanting mind. Every time you give in, it makes the imprint deeper of not being able to keep discipline. So keeping discipline is like stopping to scratch. Then it hurts and it itches, but it doesn't make the wound deeper. Have you ever had an itch that you knew you are not allowed to scratch? If you succeed, the wound heals. If you go every time you have the instinct to scratch, the wound will never heal. You know, there's this funny pleasure of pulling off scabs, isn't it? Do you have that also? I love to do that. It hurts. It's so stupid. It hurts. I know it's not good, but I love to do it. It's so stupid. So then you sit on your hand and you go, no. And then the last bit I pull off, because then the wound is not deep anymore. Okay, so we go in steps. So we say, like, not now. So like this. Okay? So the more you see your present existence as precious, meaningful, but now the next one, but very fragile, the more you will take advantage of it. The more we know it's not going to last, we become more patient, we can endure more hardships, and we're more joyful in the situation. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. That is this thing, will it last? You know, the first question in the schedule is, do we have what we need for this spiritual journey? I think we have. Next question is, will it last? No. Because we're not using it if we think it will last forever, you know? Have you ever regretted not having appreciated somebody or something when it was finished? Do you know that mind that regrets not having taken advantage of the situation when the person was still there? So we don't, because then it's too late. And we don't need to go there. We do not need to go there. We can start to appreciate now by thinking, when your mind goes a bit, but it's so difficult. Yeah, it's difficult, but it could be so much worse. This is a mind training to look into the other direction. Then it should be better. This whole thing, it should be better, is just dragging you down and blocking you. Learn the mantra, could be worse. Yeah. It really helps. Okay, so how do we think about the death thing? There is three main points. I have page 5. I don't know if you have page numbers. Probably not. It says 9-point death meditation. So there is 3 main points, and out of the, do you have then 9 roots kind of day? No. 3 root points and then 9 branches or something like that. Or 9 reasons, yeah? So the first main point is death is certain. Do we know that? Do we really know that? You know, a friend of mine has just died, Clow. Every time somebody dies, even if I see their dead body, the more I understand that I don't understand death, that it's finished. I have moments I'm totally confused about this, because also I haven't seen the body. It's very good to be there to really say, I don't understand death. I don't take this serious enough. I do not understand death. So we convince ourselves that death is certain, because if we would really know it, you know, when I I drop this, we know that it's going to break, so I'm not going to do it. Yeah, so when it's in pieces, I'm not going, oh, why is this in pieces now? But when somebody dies, we're surprised. And we say, oh, no. Or we even say, can't be. With him, you know, maybe it was easier to accept the fact that he's there because he was missing for 15 days. So if somebody's not found after 15 days, you already know that if they find it, they will probably find the body. So there was time to be able to prepare. You know, if the message would have come, Clow is dead, I don't know how I would have reacted, even knowing that he's so sick, you know. Yeah, so but it's we can see that even with others we don't understand. So then, let alone with ourselves. We're not feeling as if we are dieable. We feel as if we're immortal. That's the gut feeling that we have. Here we know it again, it's the same thing. Here we know it. But the gut feeling, the way we react, we act as if we are immortal. This is why we don't prepare for death. You see, you don't need to be afraid of death to prepare for it. You are not afraid to go on a holiday, yet you prepare for it. This will be a very important moment in your life, yet we just let it slip like this. Oh, then I will be gone and who cares? It's not like that. So we need to convince ourselves that we're going to die. How? By giving us these reasons. It's impossible to find a body that does not die. Everybody has died until now. There's nobody that we know that has lived eternally. But still we have to think, but maybe me, I will live eternally. Yeah? So we use logic. If everybody has died, that means me also. Then the other thing that's not so pleasant to think about, every moment that we live, we approach our moment of death. There is nothing that we can add on. We cannot reverse this process. You know, we regret very much losing money, for example. Do we ever regret wasting time with things that will not be of help at the time of death? Yora says, yes, me also. That's the start. We start to regret wasting time. That regret will then maybe stop us from wasting time. Do you ever think in the evening, one day less in my life that I have time to do what I really want to do? Or even a question that comes before that, do I know what I really want to do? You see, when the thing comes from the doctor, sorry, cannot help you, you have 2 more months or something like this to live, then we start to think, but what do I want to do with these 2 months? We don't have to wait until then. This is what we will discuss in the discussion group, you know, what is happiness and what is a meaningful life for you? And be honest, you know. For my mom, it was to be in as many 5-star hotels as possible. She died very peacefully, because she did. It wasn't just a dream. She made dad's money, she was able to do it. So, you know, start to ask this question. What will be important for me the moment I die? What kind of qualities will I want to have developed? What kind of things will be important that I have done? If you think death is important, then you start to live like this. The moment you start to integrate death in your life, you start living a life that is meaningful. If you just push it away, oh yeah, I'll think about this when I die, the fear of death will be sitting on your shoulder and you don't want to recognize it. So that's the next point that comes, you know, because lifespan is constantly running out, then we will start to look, what will help at the time of death? If you have a maybe I do next point for the next point first. The time of death is uncertain. Why? Because we don't have fixed lifespans. If you are a member of a fitness club, you have a card that has a date on it. If you see it expiring, even if you're tired or too, you know, before you were too lazy to go, and you see you only have one more week or two more days, what does that understanding do? You go. But unfortunately, we don't have this. We don't have a date on our card. You know, you have a number on your social security card or your medical insurance card, but there is a date, but that can be renewed. But the date that is here cannot be renewed. So this is how, you know, Precious Human Rebirth, this is how you should use it, like a card that expires. When then you look at it and it's already expired, you're at the door there, you're at the door to a good human rebirth, and you show your card and they say, sorry, expired, you know. You haven't renewed it with good karma. Shit. Other door for you now. You know, if we go to the gym, and they say, sorry, your card is expired, we wouldn't be surprised. We say, yeah, I didn't renew it. But then when we suffer, this means we haven't renewed our card of good karma, positive karma. Your bank account is empty. If you just use and use and use, at one point it gets empty. So we start to see, this is what you will discuss. What will help at the time of death? Something that we can already create now. How can we prepare for death already now? It's a very good exercise that you can do alone by thinking. You write down three or five points how you definitely, if you would have a choice, don't want to die. And then three, four, or five points how you would like to die. And then you look at this and you say, okay, what can I already do now so I can prevent from dying that way and I can die this way that I want to die? This can be life-changing, this list. Because, you know, fear of death, of dying in a fire, flood, whatever, there's nothing you can do about this. If you're in that area and there's a flood, that's it. You know, then we start to let go of these fears and we start to have healthy fears. For example, I don't want to die with an angry mind. I don't want to die without having forgiven this person. These are healthy fears. Otherwise, we keep sitting with these fears of things. How can, you know, then best just, no, I don't want to say that. But I was about to say, best you just take a gun and shoot yourself. Yeah. That's somebody who has humor there. Good. Great. Yeah, I'm happy that I didn't say it. Okay, why is the time of death uncertain? We have no fixed lifespan. We are surrounded by many causes that can cause death, not just in Israel or the Gaza Strip, also in Switzerland. Cars, houses can collapse. But in Genoa at the moment, they have huge floods. People died in these floods. It's a safe city in Italy. Yeah? Nature is so dangerous. More and more, actually. You know? Houses are dangerous. Medicine is dangerous. You take it in the wrong way. Food is dangerous. If you eat seafood, you know, and it's not fresh, what? You will never eat it again, I can assure you, because you'll get food poisoning and you vomit the whole night, and then just the thought of seafood makes you, ugh. Actually, if you want to stop eating, eat meat that is contaminated so that you vomit for at least a day. That will make you stop. If you want to stop, but you don't succeed, that's one thing you could do. And then another reason is the body is very fragile. You know, it needs so many conditions to keep this body alive. It needs so little to kill it. You know, One little virus, Ebola. Can you see Ebola coming into your body? No. Can you prevent it? Yeah, we can put on these plastic things and, you know. But even those, two people got infected. The body is very fragile. So we start to live with these facts. Yeah. Instead of being afraid of it, we start to live with these facts. Yes, the body is fragile. Yes, there are a lot of things that can cause death. Yes, my lifestyle is not fixed. What do you think will happen? You start to appreciate that despite all of these dangers around there, you're still alive. You start to appreciate life. You start to live because you know that it's not going to last. See, I've seen people's mind changing in a drastic way when they knew they only had to live for 2 or 3 more months. They became so appreciative and happy in a way that I was almost jealous. But again, we don't need to wait for this. Okay? A friend of mine has leukemia. She's in Paris in the hospital. For 1 month in a sterile room, cannot go out, you know. She is so happy because this sickness has changed the attitude of her children towards her. She will always wanted to help her children. Both of them have difficult lives because they're quite weak and needy and, you know, and she really wanted, she tried just about everything to help them. They always rejected her. She became the garbage bin for their bad moods. The son drinks, okay? She's really worried about him. She got the sickness. He stopped drinking. The daughter puts her, you know, pulls herself together and starts to look after her and starts to help her and all this. Both of them are much happier. And she said, wow, this is amazing. What I was not able to do for my two children, the sickness is doing for them now. She is totally blissed out. And she asked me, she said, do you think I'm just suppressing something or faking something? I said, no, you love your children. That's why you're happy. And you know, she says, I die, it's fine, because then my daughter gets my apartment. It's possible that this mind collapses. That is possible. But for the moment, it's genuine. I can hear it when I talk to her. It's she who doubts the mind, that it's genuine. But I said, look, but this mind can collapse. The happiness can collapse and you can go into despair. That's true. But for the moment, enjoy it. It's totally blissed out. See, not even that we can trust, that having leukemia, not she's very aggressive, yeah? And she's 70. Not knowing that you will be able to be cured can make you totally blissed out if you have the right way of thinking. Okay, so the last point here that we think about is these two first points will make you think what will help at the time of death. And then we start to see that possessions cannot help if you are very attached to them, because you have to leave them behind. Like kind of, you know, we are starting to look when I'm not well now, because it's quite possible that at the time of death you will not be well. You will be panicking, you will be full of fear. I don't know if you have seen people die. Not so many people die really peaceful, maybe the last few moments when they finally let go. But approaching death, phew, is a lot of suffering, not wanting to let go. And you see, if possessions, friends and family, and body are your only refuge where we find happiness, if that's the only thing that can help you now while you are alive, because all these three things collapse at the time of death. They can not come with you. So already now we have to learn to calm ourselves down with certain thoughts instead of going to the telephone and phoning the friend or mom or whoever. Do you see what I mean? This is how they cannot help. If they are your only resources to be happy because they help you to be happy, you will be totally abandoned. You will feel like totally abandoned at the time of death. And on top of it, not only can they not help, if you are attached to them, They will make you suffer more than necessary. You see, if you leave a hotel room, are you sad? Maybe if you have a really, really, really messy, horrible house and then you have to leave the room here, and then you're really sad because that one is better. But in general, you know, we go to hotel or here to the kibbutz. We know this is impermanent, it's not going to last. We're not putting that much effort in hanging up pictures and cleaning the room. Yeah, if you want it clean, then you can put effort into it if it's really dirty. But we're not decorating it and all that because we know it's impermanent. When you leave it, if it's clean, it's a good feeling when you leave the room clean, you know. But you leave it without being attached. You leave it, that's it. Will you be able to leave your nice house like this at the time of death, knowing that most of the things inside will be thrown away or sold? You know, it's a good thing to think about these things. Give the people that have to clean up your house already now the permission to either sell the stuff or throw it away. Because that's what happens when somebody dies. If it's a value, it gets sold. If it's of no value, it gets thrown. Isn't it? Yeah. Then maybe your possessions can help. If you have possessions that are really valuable, and you think, wow, great. You know, like this woman. So great. The daughter can have my apartment because it's mine. It will help her. Then it's good to have these possessions. When you already, while you're still alive, have given them away for others. Otherwise, no. Friends and family cannot help. If you've done good things to them, then it helps. By thinking, wow, you know, I was so beneficial to them. If you have harmed them, that will prevent a peaceful death. If you expect them to be all around your bed and crying their eyes out because you're going, but no, they're at the party, then also they cannot help because you will get angry. Give them the permission not to be there when you die because it might be too painful for them because they have to continue living. And also it's much easier to go when they're not there, by the way. Have you ever noticed if you have to, you live in a place and it's painful for you to go to another place, like, you know, to say goodbye to your children or to friends or whatever. Yeah, we've all been in that situation. Or no? Yeah, you have to say goodbye. It's painful. But when you have to go before the family gets up, it's much less pain. Much less pain. I love early morning flights and trains because everybody's still sleeping, I go. If I have to say goodbye to people that I'm really attached to, you know, it's not big pain, but it's pain. My voice is up here, my tears are coming, I look back. It's so much more suffering. And we're attached to this suffering. You know, they accompany you to the airport, they look back. You know, every time you look back, oh, I have to leave them. Why are you looking back? Go to your plane. Go into your next life. Go full of self-confidence. I did a good job in this life. Bye. And concentrate on the future and not on the past that is finished. Learn to have a peaceful, happy mind. Okay? Okay. So these three things cannot help. Especially the body cannot help because it causes death. Yeah, we're coming. Coming in 1 minute for the dining room. Please, when we finished here, if you need to go to the toilet, that's fine, but then come to the dining room, you know, so that they can swiftly then also change. Okay? So like this. Body cannot help because it causes death. And if you look, you know, how much time, money, and worries do you invest in this body? At the time of death, it says, look, I'm tired. Sorry, get out of here. I give up. You see, we don't see the attachment to the body because we always have it. You only see your attachment when you are separated from something. Then you feel the pain of not having it. As long as you have it, you don't feel that you are attached. Do you see what I mean? You're going to lose this thing that you call body at the time of death. Because it's not you. If it would be yours, you could take it along. So start to familiarize yourself with this. I am not the body. And the body will get buried. It will become food for worms. It's fine. At least it's of some benefit. If you decide to be burned, you say, well, at least it's not polluting the ground. Because, you know, with all these chemicals that people have in their bodies from chemotherapy, it goes into the ground when the body decomposes. So, but it's still food for the worms. It's fine. So you think, you know, whatever is most beneficial for the environment, this is the kind of burial I want to have. And make it positive. If it's an earth burial, it will be food for the worms. Great, you know. If it's a burning burial, which is in Europe, most of the people are getting cremated, then you think, wow, at least then it does no polluting. And whatever metal I have in the body, it can be reused. Yeah, for example. You know, you're not, if it's an earth burial, you're not cutting out these things. If it's burning, then they get they don't burn, and then they can, it can be recycled. So it's great. Yeah. We have to go anyway, you know. So let's find ways and means that it's less painful. This is what this is for. To appreciate life now and to have less problems. Where we go now? I forgot about this. Sorry. So we do this very quickly. The offering of the food. One offers the food to create gratitude. It's page 29 in the red book. And by offering the food, you can help your food problems. Because there's not so much attachment to food anymore if we offer it first. Of course, it doesn't work immediately like this. For me to be able to eat cheese, it took 20 years of practice. Okay? But now I can eat it. So, also attachment to food. I had a food addiction. I was an alcoholic and then I had food addiction. So, I'm not addicted to food anymore. It's okay. I can eat normally. Yeah? This is great, you know? Because all these addictions, they just really make you slaves. Yeah. So by offering the food, it helps with your food addiction and it creates a lot of positive energy, positive potential, a good karma, that we will not have to fight for the food. And we will always have enough things that nourish us. Not pleasure, nourish us. We don't have to create negativity to get food. Food will be available for us. So we just read it, and then if there's anything you don't understand, then I say. So there's the contemplations first, you know. I contemplate how much positive potential I have accumulated in order to receive this food given by others, because otherwise you could not go to the dining room now, because it is given by others, the food that you're going to eat. Yeah. So just think about this. I contemplate my practice, constantly trying to improve it. I contemplate my mind, cautiously guarding it from wrongdoing and greed and other defilements. I contemplate this food, treating it as medicine to nourish my body. Nourish my body. I contemplate the aim of Buddhahood, accepting and consuming this food in order to accomplish it. Then you imagine the food as blissful nectar inside a vast vessel, jeweled vessel, and recite Om Ahung to consecrate the food. I don't know if you have time that I can explain, maybe this evening. And offered to a small Buddha visualized at your heart chakra while you're eating, and he experiences blissful experiences while you eat the food. Yeah. So you're feeding the Buddha, you're not feeding yourself. It's less attachment. It's the same when you're feeding a child. You're very happy when the child is eating. So now you're feeding the Buddha. Om Ahung, Om Ahung, Om Ahung. And then these are the official verses. To the precious Buddha, the peerless guide. To the precious Dharma, the peerless refuge. To the precious Sangha, the peerless liberators. To the three jewels, we make this offering. This food, which has 100 flavors, is mouth-watering and well-made. We offer with faith to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. May all beings enjoy the food of concentration. We see this food as medicine. We eat it without attachment or aversion, not to increase arrogance, strength, or good looks, only to sustain the body. So if you treat the food like medicine, it doesn't have to be delicious. It only has to be nourishing. That's the advantage of saying these things. So please enjoy the food. And try to come quickly to the dining room if you